Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are taking a look at some local food and drink-related businesses. We'll catch up with Krista Miller of Wilkes & Wilson and hear what the fast-growing Elixir and Bloody Mary-making company has planned. We'll also talk with David Page of Cafe Nona in the Fletcher Place neighborhood in Indianapolis and hear about the gelato and other Italian treats he's brought to the neighborhood. And speaking of treats, we'll talk donuts with Kate Drury of The Dancing Donut. Then we'll switch gears and take a turn from treats to more healthful fare and hear from Matt Ewer about what's happening and what's in store for green bean delivery. And we'll wrap up with a look back at 10 years of mead and cider making with Tia Agnew of New Day Craft, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this weekend. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, these might be the lazy days of summer, and I'm all for enjoying some downtime at the lake. But the businesses in the Indianapolis food community can't take a break, and our local entrepreneurs are always busy working on their next big thing. And that's especially true with Wilkes & Wilson, the homegrown company that makes a popular line of syrups and elixirs that are found in bars and homes and who have expanded with Bloody Marys. Founders Zachary Wilkes and Greg Wilson have a lot in the works for the company. So while they were in New Orleans recently for the Tales of the Cocktail Industry event, I caught up with Krista Miller, Wilkes & Wilson's marketing whiz, and talked about what the company is up to.
There is so much going on with Wilkes & Wilson. It's a very exciting time for us right now. In 4 weeks, right in time for tailgate sessions and tailgate season, we're going to be launching our first ready-to-drink Bloody Mary mix.
Oh, my gosh, ready-to-drink. So this isn't like you have to mix it up and measure and that sort of thing. You're going to open it right from the bottle? How cool is that?
It has premium distilled vodka already in there, so all you have to do is shake it to make it.
Oh, my gosh. Now tell me how all that came about.
We've been wanting to get into the ready-to-drink because we saw that there was a void, and nobody else really had a Bloody Mary mix that was premium and that tasted good and not like red pickle juice with tomatoes kind of squished in there. And we've had such rave reviews on our Bloody Mary mix that we decided, well, why don't we explore this? And so we're ready to launch it. Our packaging is at the printer right now. We're waiting to get the final feedback from the government. And as soon as we get that okay, we are pulling the trigger and we'll be ready in time for tailgate season.
Oh my goodness. So this will be available in local stores?
Yes. All Kroger's, Marsh supermarkets, all the major liquor stores, and some of the independents too. We've had quite a few independent stores and people who are not even, carry our product are so interested in this ready-to-drink product. It's amazing.
So how did the idea come about and how long did it take to create a good recipe?
Well, it took over a year to create the Bloody Mary mix. And, you know, we launched that last November. And now with the proven success of our Bloody Mary mix, we decided to go ahead and we started working on this. And a lot of, you know, we really wanted to get it down right, wanted to check out the separation, what those issues would be. So the logical thing is you just shake it to make it. And you could drink it right out of the bottle. Each 12.7-ounce bottle that's going to be packaged in contains two Bloody Marys. The retail on the four-pack is going to be purchased as a four-pack is $18.99, which means that each bottle is $4.75, and that gives you two Bloody Mary drinks.
Oh my gosh! So each Bloody Mary drink is about $2.50. So that seems like a pretty good deal, right?
Absolutely. And just imagine for tailgates, it's going to be in a plastic bottle with a waterproof label. Throw it in your cooler with the ice. It's already going to be iced down. I do is shake it to make it.
That's a pretty catchy slogan. So obviously you have been thinking about marketing here at Wilkes & Wilson, and that is what you do, right? So you know, we have Zach Wilkes, Greg Wilson, and Krista Miller, right?
Yes, the ampersand. And we are very excited about this shake to make. We've got it copyrighted, and we are going to be launching more products in the ready-to-drink arena and the shake-to-make, such as Moscow Mules, Mojitos, Mai Tais. So we're even looking at doing some carbonation and doing our gin and tonic with our own special tonic.
Now, that is a big jump, you know, from a company that just a couple of years ago you had your elixirs and the syrups to mix drinks with. So that this is growing by leaps and bounds.
It is, and the most exciting part is that we were at a show up in Chicago in May, the Bar Show, which is part of the National Restaurant Association show, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. We had such a tremendous response that one of the head bartenders and head mixologists in the entire country, Tony Abugaman, he is bringing us into Vegas, and he is the beverage director in Bellagio. He was so impressed with our lime mint for the mojitos, he even told the entire audience that he could not make a better mojito than Wilkes & Wilson Mojito Mix, the lime mint.
Oh, my gosh, what a nice endorsement, right?
Yes. So we will be carried. We are going into Las Vegas. And so now what happens in Vegas, it stays in Vegas, what now happened with the Wilkes & Wilson cocktail.
That's fun. You must be so excited about the progress that the company has made in just a short period of time. So take me through just a little bit of the timeline of Wilkes & Wilson.
Sure. We were founded in 2012, and we we are learning from our mistakes, and we are working with our distributor. We're working with our distributor much better now with Southern, and they have really penetrated the market for Indiana for us. And we really just wanted to own Indiana first before we started to branch out. Now we have distributors in Kentucky, in Nashville. We have a distributor in Washington, D.C. We will be going to Las Vegas soon. And we also have Chicago on our sites. Probably by the end of the year, we'll be in the Chicago market.
Wow. So that's a lot of progress in just 3 years. So what were the first products that you came out with? And then how did it develop from that?
We had seven elixirs. We had our gin, which is our simple syrup. We have our grenadine. We have our ginger, raspberry, orgeat, lime mint, and our tonic. We eventually came out with a pineapple gin because we had a lot of people asking for more tiki drinks, you know, to partner with the orgeat. And then we decided, let's branch out a little bit, and we got into the Bloody Mary market. And now we're into the bitters market. We produce bitters in-house. We have our orange bitters, our Riggs Tavern bitters, which is our aromatic, and then we have a wonderful Storyville bitters, which is a coffee chicory pecan, which goes really well with brown spirits.
So the company that started out with syrups, and those were just made up, you know, for Zach and Greg, they just decided they would start making some of these, right, for use in a bar, at Ball and Biscuit,
yes.
You know. And so it just grew from that?
Yes, it did. And it's just been a tremendous growth. And we're really conscious about growing it appropriately and not going too big too fast. We really want to produce such a quality product, and we look at everything when we decide to bring out a new product, what the market impact is, how we're going to fit into a store location, what our competition is. We really do a lot of in-depth search and study to see how we're going to be able to fit in. And if we don't fit in, we're not going to launch that product and we're not going to develop it. But if we see that there's an area where we can really make a big impact, we're definitely going to take advantage and make that product fit and work.
Now, the last time we talked, I think that you were getting ready to go into the Cooper's Hawk Winery, restaurants. Now, did that has happened, and is it going well?
It is going well. We have peach, spiced apple, and pomegranate in all the Cooper's Hawk locations. They did a private label. We're working on doing a cranberry for the fall, which would be delicious with their Blanc de Blanc, as all of our products are with the Blanc de Blanc. You can't go wrong with Cooper's Hawk Blanc de Blanc. But we are working on the cranberry for them, and then we're looking for flavors for next spring, summer.
Oh, so right now, so we're just getting into to summer here in July. So you're working for next year, right?
Absolutely. We've got some really exciting flavors, some really unusual combinations we're coming up with that are, I can't really let the cat out of the bag yet, but they, trust me, they are not on the market, and it is something that we're really excited about.
Wow. Now, so people, where can people find this stuff? Where can they find more information about Wilkes & Wilson and maybe get the whole backstory of how it all came about?
Well, you can always go to our website, wilkesandwilson.com, all spelled out. And you can also buy all of our products at Marsh locations. Kroger is carrying our Bloody Mary mix and our orange bitters. Big Red Liquors has all of our products. So do Payless Liquors and Crown Liquors. We're working on getting the 21st Amendment, but there are a lot of independent liquor stores who have brought us on that we're really excited about. We love partnering with our local companies and growing, going local and growing that business.
We've been talking with Krista Miller of Wilkes & Wilson. For more information on the company, go to wilkesandwilson.com. Part of what's interesting about Indianapolis neighborhoods are how they have changed or stayed the same over the years. When Cafe Nona owner David Page was a kid, for example, there was an alley going right through what is now the dining room of his gelato shop in Fletcher Place. So the neighborhood has definitely changed in the last 50 years or so, but Fletcher Place has kept its Italian heritage, and now even more so that it has an authentic gelato shop. Cafe Nona, located at 635 Virginia Avenue, offers a wide variety of gelato, as well as Italian treats like cannolis, along with house-made Italian sausage sandwiches. I stopped by not long ago to talk with owner David Page about how he came to open Cafe Nona.
Now tell me about that ham sandwich.
Okay, when I was a little kid, I used to go on Washington Street because I worked down the city market with my family, and it was Weese's Deli. And everybody go in there and get a ham sandwich, and they couldn't believe that the Jewish people were selling ham sandwiches. But it was so good, and they just carved it right in front of you, and I fell in love with it. So over the years, I finally worked in the recipe that they had, and one of the guys worked there years ago. I confirmed the recipe with him, and he says, "You got it down pat." And then my Italian sausage I've been making since I was 13 years old.
Oh, no. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I was walking down Stephen Street one time when I was 13, and four old Italian guys were sitting in front on the porch, and they were grinding meat and stuff. And I said, "Well, what are you guys doing?" They said, "We're making sausage. You want to learn?" I said, "Well, sure." So I sat down with them. They gave me a glass of wine, and I said, "Okay." And what really caught my eye was they were using a double shot glass to measure all the ingredients. And to this day, I still use a double shot glass. And people said, "Why don't you just measure it?" I said, "No, this is the way I learned. And it came out great, so why change?"
So you're still making your own Italian sausage?
Oh yes, yes. I make it probably 200 pounds about every 2 weeks.
Oh my.
Yeah, I got people knocking my back door once.
I bet you do. Okay, now what about gelato? You know, why do the gelato?
Well, 20-some years ago, I went to Italy to visit my family there, which I had never met. And I got off the train, and I sat in a park. And I'm sitting there waiting for them to pick me up. And I looked across the street, and I seen a gelato shop, which I had never been to. So I go over there, and I start eating everything, and I fell in love with it. And I'm sitting in the park with both hands full of gelato, And here comes my cousin to pick me up and said, Nathan, what are you doing? I thought, I need gelato. And I, just every time I go back there, it's amazing. And I had a cousin that had a friend that owned one, a shop. And he took me down the basement and showed me the machinery and how he made it. And it's just been on my mind ever since. And I figured one of these days I'm going to do it. But now I got 17 grandkids and 6 great grandchildren, so I got no problem finding help.
So you make all the gelato, right?
Yes, gelato and the sorbet, which I had never eaten before. But when I got to making it, it's all fresh fruit, and, no dairy products, and it's just so smooth and gray for you. I just loved it. So I figured both of that, too.
So how many kinds of gelato do you make?
Okay, right now we're making 18. But I have the ingredients to make 50. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to, for 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to see what the most popular one is and what's less popular, and then keep changing. So I think that will work out.
Now, you also do pastries, too, right?
Yes. Cannolis is the favorite of everybody. And it happens, a young Italian boy walks in here the other day, introduced himself to me and him and his wife. And he'd been over here for a couple of years, and he showed me a couple of pictures of, he's a pastry chef. And I said, well, you bring me something, and if it's good, I'll buy it from you and sell it. So I'm waiting for him to come in.
Tell me a little bit about your restaurant background. You had La Scala, right? Yes. And, you grew up in the restaurant business,
yes,
right?
I grew up in the restaurant business. And when I was 18, I had a restaurant on Southeast Street. And then I had a restaurant on Washington Street called David's. And then I got the opportunity to open up another restaurant called La Scala's. And the city finally bought us out. But La Scala's was the restaurant. It was beautiful. I got pictures of it, and to this day it's unbelievable. La Scala means stairways. And when you walked in my restaurant, we had a big marble stairway and a balcony all around. We could seat 600 people. Yes, it was unbelievable. People came in from all over.
Now, what years were that? When was that?
In the middle 70s until the middle 80s. Yeah. And then the city came in and built the mall. Yeah. And we were where Nordstrom's was.
Okay, so that gives people an idea of where it was located. Right.
Yeah, on the South Meridian Street. And it was fantastic. And it was all family. My sisters, my brothers, and all my kids worked there. One daughter made antipastas and had a couple washing dishes. But that's how it worked. And to this day, we have Primo Banquet Hall. And my daughters and my granddaughters run that. And so this is getting the same way.
So how do you like the neighborhood? How do you like, all the action that's going here on Virginia Avenue? It's really taken off.
Well, I tell you, Virginia Avenue, I've lived here. I'm 74, and I lived here all my life. I've watched it grow. I've watched it not grow. And the different types of people up and down. But I think right now it's hitting its peak because I had a lot of property up and down Virginia Avenue, and I sold it to people that developed condos and apartments, and it's great. And they keep building. So when they keep building, you know people are coming, and they are very nice people.
What do you think of the restaurant scene up and down the street?
Yes, there is a lot of different types of restaurants. I mean, it's surprising, even over on Southeast Street. And they all seem to be good. I haven't gone to all of them, but I try to. But I'm really surprised and thankful that they are coming.
As a longtime resident, do you like the development?
Oh, yes, I love the development. In fact, the only bad part about it is there's no houses for sale, and everybody's looking for houses. And I meet some really nice people. And so I tell them, give me your number, and if I see a house for sale, I'll call you.
We've been talking with David Page of Cafe Nona, an authentic Italian gelato shop at 635 Virginia Avenue in Indianapolis. For more information on Cafe Nona, look for it on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, it's hard not to be a donut fan. I mean, what's not to like about a sweet glazed donut? Especially if it has sprinkles or maybe even bacon. Local entrepreneur Kate Drury just knew a donut shop would be a hit in Indianapolis, and after the continued success of her flying cupcake shops, there are five of them now, she knew she would open the Dancing Donut. And now there are often lines of customers waiting for those donuts. Donuts with names like the Jane Doe, the Jelly Ripa, the Copa Banana, or, yes, the Kevin Bacon. I talked with Kate after the Dancing Donut opened at 1134 East 54th Street about the business of sweet treats.
Why not another cupcake location?
It's that entrepreneurial thing that I can't help. I, like anyone else, need a little change of pace, just like anybody working in any job for 8 years. You love it. I still do. I love every day. I mean, not every day, maybe 6 days out of seven, but I wake up pretty happy. But I have been wanting to do a donut shop for 4 years. I still owned my boutique, which I haven't had for 2.5 years, when I was in my first negotiation for a donut shop. The deal had fallen through. It was going to be in Broderpool, right in Broderpool, and that was such a negative experience that I just shelved it. And then I just focused on expanding, and once I felt like I'm at a place where I want to be with the cupcakes, then I could revisit this. Now, in the meantime, there have been more that have opened, but I knew it was going to be the next. I mean, again, same thing as I did with the cupcakes. You could see that was coming years ago. So
you really did. So you saw the popularity of donuts coming, you know, while it was still down the roadways?
Yeah, like 4 or 5 years ago. Donut plant in New York and Voodoo Donut out west. It's very similar. Difference to me is donuts are something that I think they even embrace more of the population for some reason. I mean, I've got plenty of guys that come in and love the flying cupcake, but men seem to really love their donuts. So I'm definitely noticing demographically it's more split than, say, your average day if you're just looking out at who's coming in to the flying cupcake. But it's great. It just like the cupcakes, it crosses. There is no, people always say, what's your demographic? There isn't. There's no age, no race, no sexual orientation. And secondly, I don't care. Of course, as everybody knows, well, I could care less. But it just doesn't. It's everybody loves all of these things. So you're making a product really that makes everybody happy. So, and I love that. That's just how I get validation, is making something that makes people happy.
So then you start to think, well, how can you go wrong with something that makes people happy, that cuts across so many categories of customer? You know, so you're looking pretty smart here with the cupcakes and the donuts, right?
You hope so. You can go wrong. I mean, you can do things. Because I have the momentum from the flying cupcake, I don't feel like I knew that there would be an expectation, as you said earlier. So I try to take time, and I've been, along with my kitchen manager, developing these recipes for months and months in our Karma location. So we had these locked in before I signed a lease. I knew the yeast was the biggest thing. I mean, people might also, although the feedback on pricing has been very positive, but, I mean, they're not an 89-cent Kroger donut, but these guys come in at 10 p.m. That is when they start, the night before. Start with the dough process, and it's all night long. It's all hand-rolled, hand-cut. It's all scratch. The glazes, everything, the ganache, everything. So it's a lot of prep to do it by 7 a.m. And then at the end of the day, you do it again for the next day. So it is a lot of work. So that part has definitely been a challenge for me to kind of get back into that groove of being in the kitchen as opposed to being out of the kitchen. So
now, how do you go about developing the recipes for that? How long did it take you to come up with the menu?
Well, the menu is, once you get your basics, the menu kind of writes itself. I am a huge fan of Pinterest. I'm not going to say I'm the most, you know, the saying that I believe in, this comes from practicing law, there's just nothing new under the sun. And while I appreciate a good innovative anything, very rarely is there something where I say, oh, I've never seen that, I haven't thought of that. Pinterest is a fabulous resource to find things that maybe you didn't think of putting together. So I do look there. But then just I take feedback from all of our, we have a lot of culinary grads that work for us, their input. And then just once we got the yeast down, we'd put the different things together. We'd make a bunch of different things, fillings, compotes, glazes, icings, like, and mix them up. Okay, let's throw bacon on it. I've got many things up in this brain, but if I add one more thing to this menu right now, I'm going to be in big trouble. So I'm not doing that. I'm going to slowly add, because that is what I did with the flying cupcake. It just doesn't seem like it now. I kind of like, all right, I didn't have 50 flavors to start. I had 12, so...
Oh, and then tell me a little bit about that. So you had just a dozen options?
We did, and we just started slowly adding them. I mean, it was myself and my manager that we were the only ones in there. We'd say, let's try a Mississippi mud. Now, that was not my better. I mean, it actually tasted really good. It was a hot mess that was literally very messy, so it's still, to this day, not on that menu. But I remember just, we call it Test Kitchen Tuesday. That's how we did it at the Flying Cupcake. Here, it's like every day is just trying to get through. The response has been so positive that we've been very busy, and we're producing more every day to try very hard not to sell out before 3. The first 2 days, admittedly, I was shocked at the response. I had no idea. There was a line outside and around the corner.
That's what I heard. One of the other shop owners told me. She came in and she said there was a line all the way around the building.
It was.
Was that the first day?
The first and second day. And they waited. I asked them, like, how long did you wait? And people were waiting 40 minutes to an hour, which it made me feel just bad about that. I felt very bad. Like, so we had to kind of, we were close Sunday and Monday just for now, and we're closed this Sunday and Monday, and then the following week we'll be open 7 days a week. I just had to make sure the staff had time to regroup, and that's the responsible thing to do as a business owner. That's a perfect example of how I underestimated my needs in the kitchen, so I've had to add and train, which is fine, we'll get there, but that's why we have this weird Sunday Monday close. What's that? I don't know, but that's why I don't have enough people. So
but soon it'll be 7 days a week, right?
We have just this weekend closed again, and then it's 7 days a week barring some kitchen catastrophe. But I think we're good. I think we're ready. Every day they get more efficient. I mean, you don't want to sacrifice the process, so it is a process. Yeast working with raised, I mean, it's not like you can just, with baking, I mean, it's all scientific. You can't just let things sit. They chemically react, and there's all those considerations, and so it's just getting a flow.
Now, how many donuts are you going through a day?
Today, from the looks of it, the rain slowed us down a little today, admittedly, but every day we are ending at about, right at about 3 with maybe 2 or 3 donuts left, and we're making between 600 and 700.
That's a lot of donuts.
That's a lot of donuts, and that's not, I mean, I already, for tomorrow, I have over, for Friday, I have over 1,000 on the list. Now, we also get an extra 3 or 4 dozen, well, tomorrow we'll get 6 dozen from Raw, the gluten-free location for the Flying Cupcake. This kitchen is prone to cross-contamination, so for the people who are truly gluten-free due to, like, celiac disease of some sort, of allergy, we bring those in fresh every morning. They go in at 4 a.m., they make them there at that location, and then, again, there could be cross-contamination here, but we do take great care to minimize that risk. But so that's, when we say we have gluten-free options, we really do have gluten-free options. And then we also have gluten-free and vegan that we fry here in their own fryers, but they are made on site, so I always caution people about that. But we do offer that, because I know that was probably the next question that came up the most, is will you have things like you do at Raw? No, not like completely. That's a totally dedicated location.
Well, now tell me about that a little bit.
That was 2.5 years ago. Illinois Street, when you open other locations, it's not like generally your business just doubles. You are kind of pilfering off of one location because the people were driving. And Illinois, which is my first location and my little special baby, that took a little bit of a hit. And I felt like people were, that had come to that and given me all that business for all those years, when we moved the commissary to Carmel, that was really troubling to them. They were missing that aspect of it. It's an open kitchen as well. So we brought it back, and we bake on site there the gluten-free and vegan options. So there is no gluten or dairy on site there, raw ingredients. We do offer our regular cupcakes there, but they are brought in, and everything is very color-coded and specialized, and boxes are different, and gloves are different, and tongs are different, and they're put in a different case. So that's how that has evolved. In fact, we were just on this vegan roadie show. That is an awesome little project that they have a blog and everything. And he had come to Indianapolis, and we were one of the few restaurants that he picked. And my manager over there, Kelly Miles, has been with me, I don't even know how many years now, but she is also vegan. So the people who work there generally either are practice one or the other, both. And so they can really relate to the customer. So if you have questions or concerns, they understand and they can answer them, and they take that very seriously. So that's how it evolved. So in those cupcakes, if you have two or three, some are gluten, some are, you can't tell. You wouldn't know what's not there. That's what I always say, is you don't know what's not in it.
I wonder, that's kind of a nice way to look at it, right?
You don't know what you're missing. You just know it's a good product. It's still all made from scratch, still all hand-mixed and everything. It's just smaller batches without dairy and without animal products or gluten.
Now, are there other things coming down the road? More donut shops somewhere else?
I'm always thinking, and even though it's like when I had my kids, I always thought you need like that downtime before you can think about it again, and I have three. Yes, I could definitely see adding another donut location, but I won't rush into it. We're going to get this right and listen to, you know, anyone's concerns. So far the feedback has been very positive, so I'm very happy with that. But, you know, you just have to settle in for a little while. Make sure you're really as good as you think you might be, and make sure. And then you have to kind of do your research. Once I commit, though, I, like I said, I'm 0 to 10. Once I make the decision, I'll find that spot in a matter of months, start the build out, and have at it.
We've been talking with Kate Drury of the Dancing Donut in Indianapolis. For more details, check out thedancingdonut.com. Well, Indianapolis has so many local food-related businesses, and some are becoming very well-known. And one of those is Green Bean Delivery. You've probably seen the vans making deliveries around town, and now Bean LLC is the parent company of Green Bean Delivery, Tiny Footprint Distribution, and two certified organic farms. And it employs more than 200 people and operates 6 distribution hubs. After the grand opening of its new Indianapolis headquarters, I sat down with co-owner and CEO Matt Ewer to hear about where Green Bean is now and where it's going. Tell me a little bit about the new headquarters.
Well, we're right off of Emerson and I-70 here in Indianapolis. We built a DC as well as a headquarters, so a distribution center, as well as a corporate headquarters. So it matches our office facility needs with the ability to buy and sell a little bit differently with more capacity and things like that. So where the company is going to go from here, continue to grow its home delivery. We truly believe in what we do, and we've seen the impact that our business has on family farms and on our partners. So we truly believe in that. We just expanded to Nashville in January, Nashville, Tennessee. So that's our sixth metro market. We see the farm continuing to grow. You know, one of the hardest industries is fresh fruits and vegetables. You don't see a lot of people doing it. You certainly don't see a lot of people ramping that up to really gain brand recognition and really understand how to make an impact and hopefully influence future people to get involved in the industry. As the demand goes up for local food, where's the supply going to come from? And that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer, and that's why we went back to the farm from our home delivery to go back and say, hey, we need to get our boots on the ground. We really need to ramp this side of our business up to create agricultural solutions for future generations.
So in ramping that up, do you anticipate expanding the farms, more farms, that sort of thing?
I do. We're already in talks to expand acreage as of this year. We've got some really cool partnerships. I can't quite let them out of the bag yet. When I do, I'll call you up and we'll have another conversation. But we've got some really cool, exciting things happening that are both based in nonprofit from an educational standpoint and for-profit in the aspect of volume and really making a farm that actually cranks out food. So, yeah.
So now what does it take to do that? You know, you mentioned that not a lot of the fruit and vegetable farms are expanding. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges to do that? Because it seems like there needs to be more of that.
There does need to be more, and from a food security standpoint, from a national standpoint, there needs to be more of it. A lot of people look at that as just a local issue or a local problem. When you've got California drying up, and they produce a great portion of certified organic vegetables and fruit, we really need to think about that as a nation. And that creates instability from a pricing standpoint. If something happens, let's say in Florida, a freeze comes in late, or something happens in Cali where there's a drought, and all of a sudden, you know, a large portion of one commodity like broccoli is not on the marketplace, the price of that product is going to fluctuate, drastically. So it's important to think about that from a national aspect. The reason that it's not here is because it's the toughest business in the world. It is, there's so many variables to it. You're dealing with Mother Nature. You're dealing with a marketplace that's based on a national level when you have local challenges. So, you know, somebody may have an advantage of being able to grow all year. Somebody might have, which is obviously easier to run your business that way because you've got more sales. So a lot of those things, I think, our company at Green Bean Delivery and the support that our members have given us, they're buying into something that's bigger. They're buying into something that has more identity to it than just a brick-and-mortar grocery store. And by that, what I mean is part of the challenge for us to do what we do has to come through the support of Green Bean Delivery members because they continually support us all year, so we can put that money back into the farm each and every year, and we can continue to grow that. Part of the challenge is you've got to have capital. So you've got to have capital investments. You've got to have a post-harvest production facility. A lot of people that are just existing off of growing fruits and vegetables can't get over that hump. They can't buy the equipment that they need. They can't get the people that they need. They can't provide the HR to keep the people that they need. So there's a lot of those challenges that I think Green Bean Delivery helps us alleviate.
Now, you also talked about your own brand. You know, now tell me a little bit about that.
Which brand? Farm to Kitchen Foods?
Yes.
Well, we have a private label brand, Farm to Kitchen Foods, and Farm to Kitchen Foods is only available through Green Bean Delivery. And what we focused on with Farm to Kitchen is basically fresh products. So we do a lot of bulk product. Like if you went into a store and saw all the bulk goods, we will put that in a package for you, put nutritional information on there for you, put the ingredients that are listed on there for you, and make that in a sealable bag. We're interested in doing things like cut fruit and eventually adding a deli component of what we do.
Really?
Yeah.
So what are some other ideas or products or different aspects of the company that maybe, you know, you're thinking about, or we could, you know, look for down the road a ways?
We've always thought about restaurants. You know, maybe we get into that directly off of our farm. I am always challenging my marketing department to what I call think outside of the bin, right? Everybody knows us for our green bin. So I think we're at the precipice as a business of understanding how to utilize our assets. And that's always a challenge for a person that's leading a company, is to get people to say, don't do the same old trick. I know that it's safe. I know that it looks good and all those type of things. But we have to continue to challenge ourselves to understand what people are looking for and what services they're going to be looking for. The main thing that we're working on is tech. So how do we improve technology? We put over $1 million into software over the last couple years. We built our own software service, our own program here in-house, and that enables us to then have a solid foundation to put bells and whistles on, and to do things like menu features or have you be able to order a product that like a pizza, right? Then get all your ingredients with it. So those are some of the things that we're working on now.
Now tell me a little bit about your own background and how you came to be doing this and how the idea sort of came to you.
I'm a lifelong food person. I started selling sweet corn door to door off my family farm when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So I've always been an entrepreneur. It just inherently is in my blood. I can't help it. Sometimes I wish I could, but I can't. From there, I went to IU, stayed within as I worked through school, I continued to work in the food service industry. So I was with Scholars and Bakehouse for a while. I drove up to Indy and handled the Indianapolis route while I was in college. And then I worked for Strangers Hill, which was a certified organic farm. But I knew by the time I was 19 that I was going to run my own company and start my own company, and that's what I wanted to do. So I wasn't going through school necessarily to get a conventional job out of school. I was going to school to hopefully, obviously gain an education, hopefully some wisdom alongside of that, and understand. I went to SPIA, so School of Public and Environmental Affairs, I got a degree in environmental management. And I've used that degree and what I learned there to try to make an impact through my business as a social mission-driven business. From there, I went to Seattle, where my wife went to get her master's degree in nutrition. And I met my mentor out there, Andrew Stout. He worked for a company, or he owned a company called Full Circle Farm. I ran a CSA. And through that, we started to build software and started to manage the farm as well. And while I started to manage the farm, we morphed that CSA into a network more, where we were buying and selling off of other people and growing that food ourselves. We ended up taking that to Alaska, where people would order up in Alaska, and we would take Washington State-grown family farm food in a couple different ways up to Alaska. So that's really where you know, I got my experience from. So by the time I started my company, we started it with next to nothing, but we had a boatload of experience.
We've been talking with Matt Ewer of Green Bean Delivery. For more information on the company's story, check out greenbeandelivery.com. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. 10 years ago, two local scientists with a beekeeping hobby started New Day Meadery, a small honey winery in Elwood, Indiana. Since then, Tia Agnew and Brett Canaday have seen their little boutique winery morph into a craft meat and hard cider company, and now New Day Craft has a tasting room in Fountain Square and bottles its lines of popular carbonated meads and hard ciders for distribution throughout the state. This weekend, New Day is celebrating 10 years in business, and its popularity just keeps growing. To see for yourself, just plan on standing in line the day after Thanksgiving to get some of New Day's special seasonal Imperial Breakfast Magpie. Co-owner Tia Agnew fills us in on the backstory of how New Day Craft came to be. Tell me just a little bit about the history of the company and how you came to make craft meat and cider.
Sure. Brett and I, we like to joke, or at least I like to joke, that New Day Craft is a hobby gone horribly wrong. Many, many moons ago, we were amateur beekeepers. And because Brett and I don't do anything small, we started off with 10 hives, which for those who don't know, that's around 500 pounds of honey.
Oh my goodness.
So yes, we couldn't eat that all. We couldn't give it all away. We couldn't even sell it all at a farmer's market. So the next logical thing was to make alcohol, right? Because that's what we do. So we were doing this just amateur mead makers, mead being, of course, an alcohol made with a base of honey. And as this fermentable sugar source, to get technical, we were doing this, having a good time, and we're both scientists, so we have lab trials and notebooks and yeast trials, all this stuff, strictly for hobby. While we were doing this, at the same time, just as a little background with Brett and I, we've lived and worked all over the nation. Brett's done some work overseas as well. And we were both from Indiana. We're happily living here back in Indiana. But we knew that sooner or later our careers were going to take us out of the state again. We were tired of moving, so this was our answer to the brain drain. We took this hobby of mead making and decided to go commercial. So technically, we're one of the state's wineries, but honestly, we really fall somewhere between a winery and a brewery. We really correlate more with the breweries just because of our product line, which I'll explain in a minute. So that was open to the public 8 years ago for New Day. We started in the small town of Elwood, Indiana, where my husband's from. And about 4 years ago, we decided to, in order to grow the business, to move it to where our customers are, which is here in Fountain Square, here in the Indianapolis area. So that was a real big kickstart. We over doubled sales in 1 year's time. It was amazing. And with that kind of momentum, we decided about 3 years ago to do a product line extension that simply stated we were making mead that resembled more of a fine wine. And we decided, let's add something else that we can offer our customers. Well, we started doing carbonated cider and mead. We thought, oh, it'll be a nice addition. Won't people like that? It'll be so novel. Well, as of last year, that's now all we make. We found out very quickly that the carbonated line was, we were selling 100 growlers to one bottle of the other style. We loved it all, but just any good, sensible business owner follows what their customer desires. So a year ago, we now only make the carbonated crafted cider and mead. And we have since then rebranded. We used to be called New Day Meadery because that's all we made was mead. And now, because we make both craft cider and craft mead, we're New Day Craft.
So now tell me a little bit about the products. People might not be aware of what a craft cider or a craft mead is.
Sure, sure. Okay, cider's a little easier to get your brain around. More people are familiar with a hard cider. If you've had a Strongbow or an Angry Orchard, it's simply an alcohol made from pressed apples. It's in its simplest form. We do a number of different varieties. And then, of course, it's carbonated. It's between 6 and 8% ABV, alcohol by volume. Typically, it could be sweet. It could be dry. We do a whole different range of styles. Now, with our mead, we do a set of mead that is very similar to the cider. It's carbonated. Again, it's 8 to 10% ABV, a little bit higher alcohol. But instead of apples, we use honey as the base. In our case, for all of our meads that we make now, it's honey and another fruit, at least one other fruit, like blueberries or cherries. Now, these can be dried as sweet as well. They drink, again, more. They're more beer-ish as far as when people think because they're carbonated. I always say everything we make is very much like a hard cider. We do have a few styles that are hopped, so they taste a little bit more like a beer. We have some that are barrel-aged. We have some that are very sweet, some that are very dry, all over the map. But they definitely kind of fit that gluten-free but really tasty alternative to beer. And we coalesce a lot with the breweries now for the simple fact we're on tap, and they really liked having us at their different events.
Now, tell me a little bit about the progression of going from making wine from honey and bottling it and how it, you know, looks like a bottle of wine, to making these carbonated beverages that are sold in bottles and growlers, right?
Sure, sure. We, as I said, 8 years ago, we began as more of a fine winery model. Our bottles were average price point of $20 a bottle. Bottles for a $7.50, a traditional wine bottle. They're still not carbonated, bone dry to very sweet. They were meant, all of our products now are still very food friendly, but they were specifically meant to show you what you could else you could do with mead, that mead could be at that time a fine wine, just as a nice grape-based wine could. You know, we would give you specific food pairings we would suggest and really kind of showcase the idea that just because it's a non-traditional ingredient for a fine wine, it still could be a fine wine. We've since kind of evolved our business, and we love those styles, but they've gone bye-bye. We have now brought in the craft mead and cider, which are carbonated, and they are actually bottled in beer bottles and beer growlers now. Again, very food-friendly, but lighter weighted, very, very easy drinking, extremely food-friendly. That's pretty much the main difference. And we found with our customers, they're much more approachable.
I think that's interesting. Why do you think that is? Do you think that perhaps they seem more familiar with it, or why do they seem more approachable?
I just think for some folks, when we were in more of a traditional wine bottle, if I had like hardcore wine drinkers, they were a little off-put by the fact it wasn't a traditional grape wine, whereas if people were, say, not big wine drinkers, they may be a little intimidated. Our packaging, I have to say, was very, very fine, very nice. The price point was rather high for Indiana-based wines and for wines in general. Typically, people don't like to spend, as a general rule, more than 15 a bottle for just the casual consumer versus the collector. So I think we were in, and people loved it. Once I get it in their mouth, they were like, this is great. But I think it was a little intimidating on one hand, a little off-putting on the other hand, depending on the person. Now that our products are carbonated, I didn't expect this, but I guess I can understand it. People, their barriers come down a little bit, whether if they're a fine wine drinker, they're like, oh, it's carbonated, oh. They feel much more relaxed about it. Or if they're a craft beer drinker, they're like, oh, cool, a new carbonated product. I want to try this. What is this crazy stuff? If they're not a seasoned wine drinker or beer drinker, they're like, oh, this is interesting. People just have really a much more open attitude about the product now. And simply, I don't think it's any less or more approachable as a specific beverage. I just think the way people perceive it now, they're much more open to it. I have a much broader demographic.
So what can people expect when they come into the tasting room?
Sure. Our tasting room, just like any other brewery or our winery tasting room, we have set open hours. You come on in. You can have a full flight tasting, a selection of 6 varieties for $5. 6 are of your choice. You can grab a little bit more differently. We're kind of also a lounge kind of setup, so we don't expect you just to do a tasting, grab a bottle, and go. We have seats. We have couches. We have some small food plates. You can grab a glass. We have events like Meet and Need on Wednesdays where for $10 gets you a massage and a glass of your choice. You know, we make it more of an event here. You can hang out with your friends. We even have a private event space in the back that a lot of groups rent out for birthday parties to bachelorette parties and business meetings. But when you come in, you just go up to the bar and say, I'd like to do a flight, or you might grab a... We also do sparkling cocktails as well with our products.
Well, now tell me a little bit about that. That sounds kind of interesting.
In order to, again, offer my customers something different, I do sparkling cocktails where I have my own simple syrups. We bring in bitters. I don't have other alcohols, but I might bring in juices. They're basically like a riff on the Prosecco or champagne cocktail because, again, our stuff's all carbonated. We have them in champagne flutes, and they're dry to sweet. Some just different fun little beverages that people, you can't take those to go in growlers, of course, but I give people the recipes all the time.
We've been talking with Tia Agnew of New Day Craft, located at 1102 Prospect Street in Fountain Square. For more on the growing company and its 10-year anniversary celebration, look for it on Facebook or check out newdaycraft.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thanks for tuning in to Eat Drink Indiana Radio this week, and thanks also to our guests, Krista Miller of Wilkes & Wilson, David Page of Cafe Nona, Kate Drury of The Dancing Donut, Matt Ewer of Green Bean Delivery, and Tia Agnew of New Day Craft. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.